You're listening to an OTB AM podcast. You can watch the show or listen live every weekday morning from 7:45 AM. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream for more stuff just like this.
All right, good morning. You're very welcome to Friday's Off the Ball, 19th of April. Good Friday. We're kicking off Easter weekend. And as is the way things work in here, the big dogs, Ger and Owen, are away on holidays all week. So we've had to bring in a novelty aspect to Off the Ball AM for the last few days. A few stand-in presenters here or there. Today it's Neil Tracy. And we're teaming it up today because we have another Tracy here. Keane Tracy is alongside me.
The dream team.
The dream team. Different spelling of the surname, though. I'm the correct version.
Is that what you say?
I'm the correct version, yeah.
Always A-C-E-Y. Always.
E-A. Always E-A-C-Y. But yeah, that's how we're teaming it up today. Two Limerick people as well. So there is going to be a little bit of a focus on rugby this morning. Looking forward to a big weekend, Keane?
Yeah. I don't think the rugby can kind of come soon enough. It's been sort of such a strange week with the agenda has been just dominated by Israel Folau, but even Upola, which has been disappointing because it's taken away from what is the biggest week of the club season. So yeah, the game tomorrow can come quick enough, really.
Yeah, you do have a story that we're going to get to soon enough on a bit of team news from Munster as well. Just a reminder as well, we are streaming across all our social platforms this morning, live across Twitter, on Periscope, also on YouTube and Facebook. We do have a lot coming up this morning. We'll just get it up on screen there in the next couple of minutes. We'll be looking through the sports pages. Then at 8 o'clock, Alan Quinlan is going to join us and we're going to talk through this weekend's Champions Cup games. Munster in action again. Saracens tomorrow in Coventry. That is going to be a commentary game on News Talk and Off the Ball tomorrow afternoon. Daniel Harris will join us at around 8:30 to look ahead at the weekend's football. Big weekend tomorrow in the Premier League. Man City and Spurs going head-to-head just a couple of days after that incredible Champions League game at the Etihad Stadium. And also Liverpool then with the chance probably to go back to the top of the table if Man City can overtake them on Saturday. Liverpool on Sunday, they are away to Cardiff in desperate need of a win themselves, after a very good 3 points against Brighton during the week, which has brought them very much back into the survival mix. And also then as well from 8:45, we have a very long, very interesting piece from Andy Lee with Cathal O'Grady that we're looking forward to bringing you, and all of that between now and 9:30. Up first, though, it is the sports pages. OK, so a lot to get through in the sports pages this morning. First of all, on the back of the Irish Independent, the big story: clubs told stand up and fight. Club Players Association threatens strike action as anger grows with the GAA's top brass over fixture crisis. This is from Michael Verney, saying that the Club Players Association could take the nuclear option and propose strike action over what they perceive as continued inaction from the GAA's top brass in their efforts to solve the current fixture crisis. Also there in the bottom left corner, you can see a little bit of a scoop from Keane and from Rory O'Connor as well, one of his colleagues in the Irish Independent. Earl set to miss Munster semi. Keith Earls is expected to be ruled out of the Champions Cup semi-final against Saracens tomorrow. He's been struggling with a thigh injury, missed the last couple of games, and although it appeared that he trained fully earlier in the week, it looks now like when the team is named at around 12 o'clock, he is not going to be in it. Also as well, Waterford in limbo as Euro denial prompts owner exit fear. So the future of Waterford FC is very much up in the air at the moment after the FAI confirmed last night they would not be part of the Irish representatives in the Europa League for next season. That's after they hadn't been in existence for 3 years, so they wouldn't be eligible to play. What's in the Examiner, Keane?
The Examiner lead with Ronan O'Gara's column tomorrow is possibly the most Munster of scenarios, a dangerous underdog. It's a very good column, actually, Ronan O'Gara going through the potential pitfalls for Munster. On top, they have fond farewell, retiring best, wants to finish career with World Cup glory, and I suppose that's been a theme throughout the papers this morning. Lots of nice tributes to the Ireland captain, who confirmed yesterday that he's going to finish all rugby. I think it was probably expected, but now we have the confirmed news. Just other couple of bits and pieces. Safe passage. Arsenal and Chelsea book semi-final tickets. Final four at Cruyff Derby would be the fairy tale Champions League climax. That would be pretty cool, I think. Road to recovery.
That was one, actually. I'd kind of forgotten about that over the last few days. That kind of just passed me by, the notion of Barca against Ajax. in the Champions League final, Cruyff Derby. That'd be pretty special.
Oh yeah, all the Premier League fans are Liverpool and Spurs would certainly wouldn't be happy. But yeah, it'd be, in fairness, the two semi-finals should be class if the quarterfinals are anything to go by. Couple of other bits here. Road to recovery. Richie McCarthy vows Limerick career won't end like this. And Paul Rouse, the athletics club that shaped life in the Midlands.
Okay, on the back are the sports section of the Irish Times today. Emotional Best to end his career after the World Cup. It's Rory Best's announcement yesterday and confirmation that he will retire fully from rugby after the World Cup in Japan this year. And class outfit to lose will be great challenge. That's what Luke McGrath says. Jerry Thornley is writing there ahead of Leinster against Toulouse on Sunday. And also there on the far side, Folau case could turn on point of New South Wales law. So Israel Folau's potential challenge to his sacking could turn on whether his conduct occurred in New South Wales, a legal expert has said. We had Jack Anderson on the show earlier in the week, I believe, to talk a little bit about that. And it looks like something that could carry on for a little while yet.
Yeah, the Irish Daily Mail lead with in flying form. Delaney enjoys Germany trip as crisis deepens. I don't know if you saw the picture that was doing the rounds of John Delaney over, I think it was in Frankfurt.
Yeah.
Sitting down having a meal. It's in relation to that.
Hold it up there towards the camera.
Philip Quinn is writing that John Delaney may be on gardening leave, but that didn't stop him being a guest with the Leinster Football Association. So, the saga rumbles on, I suppose, and I see in another story today that his credit card was stopped as well for the FAI. So, yeah, it rumbles on. London Calling, Arsenal and Chelsea reach semis. And then Philip Lanigan is writing about the club furore as well. Furious club players threaten revolt against GAA.
OK, on the back of the Irish Daily Mirror, Poch, this is our destiny. Fate and hard work can take us to Euro glory. That is Mauricio Pochettino saying there's a sense of destiny driving Spurs' Champions League ambitions this season. And a few screen grabs also as well of, I don't know, did you see the video doing the rounds yesterday of Pochettino's celebrations after
it was
the
game? Wasn't it?
Giving it the big balls, the big balls celebration. Pochettino going crazy in the Spurs dressing room after the win. He was talking about just how much of a roller coaster of emotion that last minute or so was when, you know, we all saw the video of Pep Guardiola doing the rounds where he thought they were through to the last four and then VAR pulls it back, and likewise then Pochettino was probably going through similar things just at opposite times.
It was a montage maker's dream, really, wasn't it? There were so many different clips. I mean, I don't know, did you see the one about the City fan? He left just after the goal, so he didn't know.
VAR.
It's absolutely brilliant. Like, you know, you can't make this stuff up. The Irish Daily Star, Poch just go, similar team there to what you had, Neil. Alexander the Great, in reference to Lacazette last night putting Arsenal through. And Carlo Kane is also writing about the player's body slams GAA. So pretty similar messages there in the Irish Daily Star.
Yeah, and just a couple more to get through quickly here. This is in the Irish Sun this morning. Napoli 0, Arsenal 1. Good lack, bad luck. Unai Joy marred by Rambo blow. That's after Arsenal went through to the Europa League semi-finals. Where they're going to take on Valencia now. Alex Lacazette's brilliant free kick is what saw them over the line yesterday. It was 3-0 on aggregate in the end after a 1-0 win in Naples. Lacazette's free kick. The bad luck, though, Aaron Ramsey went off what looked like a hamstring injury. So who knows? It looked like a small tweak, but you'd never know. We might well have seen the last of Aaron Ramsey in an Arsenal shirt. Hopefully not, though. It'd be good to see him get a couple of games towards the end of the season. And also a small little piece there on the left-hand side, which we'll probably ask Daniel Harris about when we have him on the line later on. Ollie's rage. This is an exclusive by Neil Custis. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer tore into Manchester United's flops after their Barcelona humiliation, accusing them of not giving 100%. It seems like Solskjaer only... the ink is barely dry on the contract, and the complications of being the permanent manager rather than the substitute teacher are starting to creep in. Yeah. And just, you have one more there.
The Herald here, Klopp, forget about Messi. Pretty much easier said than done, really, I would suggest. I think Klopp is saying that the focus is going to be on the next two Premier League games, which again, it's going to be tough not to have one eye on Barcelona.
Yeah, I'd imagine it's very tough.
Yeah. Aidan Fitzmaurice here writing as well about Delaney not on FAI business, which is obviously in relation to the story we just talked about. And Richard Dunn, Pep now has mental block over Europe, which is been a very interesting talking point, I suppose, after the game during the week.
And also finally then as well, Canaries are close. This is on the back of the Racing Sport. Canaries are so close, but return to the big time may have to wait for Norwich. That's Norwich. If they win tonight against Sheffield Wednesday in the Championship, they could get promoted tomorrow automatically. That is if Sheffield United lose in their kick-off against Nottingham Forest. And also Spurs 20-21 to secure a final place. That is just a short little story about how Spurs are narrow favourites early on ahead of the Champions League semi-final with Ajax. We do have a couple of back pages from the UK papers. This is on the back of the... Is this the Guardian, Tommy? This is the back of the Guardian. Pochettino's great escape. Spurs manager feared massive emotional toll of City defeat. And a picture there as well just of Pedro scoring for Chelsea yesterday as they wrapped up their Europa League semi-final place. A similar picture of Pedro as well on the back page of the Telegraph. My eyesight is not great at the moment. Should have brought the glasses this morning, actually. Blues cruise, that's after Chelsea's 4-3 win yesterday against Slavia Prague. That sets up a semi-final against Eintracht Frankfurt. Now, a couple of stories to get to. One that we just touched on there going through the back pages, Cian, that is of Keith Earls, set to miss Munster's semi-final against Saracens tomorrow. It's not 100% confirmed, but it's more or less confirmed that Joey Carberry is going to miss. We're kind of taking that as a given.
Yeah.
It looked at the start of the week like Keith Earls was probably going to pull through. We got the impression that he trained fully on Monday. He'd sat out the last two games, was what we were told. It was just precautionary, a bit of tightness in his thigh. But it appears now when the team is named at about 12 o'clock, he's not going to be in it.
Yeah, that's...
What do you know about it?
That's the information I have. Obviously, we'll see at 12 o'clock when the team comes out. I don't think he trained fully on Monday. I think he did the warm-up and was there for the pictures, for the snappers and things. But I don't think he actually completed the full training session. And I suppose it goes, you know, Joe Schmidt never picks players if he can't train in the early part of the week. And Keith Earls knows his body better than most people. We saw that during the Six Nations as well against England. Remember, he picked up the injury earlier on and... Mm-hmm. He just wasn't the same player playing through it, but if it's confirmed, I think it's a massive loss for Munster. Like you said, already without Joey Carberry, their main attacking threat, Keith Earls has arguably been their best player this season. He's been in sensational form. We saw it against Edinburgh, how important he was in such a tight game, you know, to mix it up. There's also doubts about Jean Kloin. Now, he may play, but, I mean, I think he has to play as well, especially when you're going up against the Saris pack who... You like your scrums, obviously, but you know what Sean Kloin brings as the tight head packing down there behind John Ryan is absolutely crucial. Now, he may play, he probably will play, but I don't think he's 100% fit either. So that's big worries for Munster.
He missed the semi-final 2 years ago.
Yeah, and
when they played Saracens.
He's been an incredible signing as well because he's a perfect foil for Tadhg Byrne. He allows Tadhg Byrne get around and do what he wants. And when you look at Saris are getting their players back, Munster are losing a couple of theirs. It was already a tough ask. It's become even tougher.
Who's coming in for Earls, are we expecting?
I believe Darren Sweetnam will probably start. So you'll have a back three of Darren Sweetnam, Andrew Conway and Mike Haley at fullback. Darren Sweetnam is having a very good season as well. I just think Keith Earls has been sort of out there on his own as the most outstanding Munster back three, and maybe even the most outstanding Irish back three player this year.
Mm-hmm. And Tyler Blaindell, I heard a sniff of a rumour yesterday there might have been a knock going with him. I didn't hear anything more of it. You didn't hear anything, though?
No, well, I didn't, but that's not to say that's not true either.
Right, I'll put that one out. I'll throw water on that one there now for now.
Yeah, no, well, they certainly need him. Although JJ Hannon did play very well last week against Benetton, and actually Ron O'Gara is writing that he's almost become the forgotten man. But the stage is set for Tyler Blaindall now, isn't it? He's overcome his injuries. It's probably time to deliver now on that.
Yeah, like a redemption day, I suppose, given he had a frustrating outing 2 years ago when he played against Saracens. Now, before we get Alan Quinlan on the line, we'll come back to Keith Earls in a couple of minutes. One of the stories doing the rounds and most of the back pages as well, the Club Players Association threatening strike action as, I suppose, just the frustration with the GAA over the fixture crisis continues. Some very interesting lines here from a statement that was given out yesterday. This is from the Club Players Association issued to members yesterday afternoon. It was the chairperson Micheál Brody and secretary Michael Higgins who detailed the frustration with the GAA top brass at a lack of progress. We cannot say with certainty that we are being listened to at management level, but we all know players are listening. So we are now looking for action, not words. As GAA members, we already know what we are, but we also know what we could be if our leadership can find the courage, the will and the foresight to move decisively on fixtures. The proposed fixtures group, properly constituted, presents an opportunity for a real lasting legacy beyond a new manifesto published and promoted at a cost to the GAA. If our GAA is truly a place where we all belong, then we need action, not words. We stand ready, as we have been since 2017. We'll be in touch again soon to update you on the next steps, including possible escalation. It's an enormously frustrating time. Like, I stopped playing Gaelic games when I was probably about 15 or 16, so...
Like myself.
Yeah, I can't really put myself into the position that club players are in, but we do have a lot of people in the office here who play hurling, play football for their clubs at home, and just the frustration non-stop. I'm always hearing the frustration of them. This club month at the moment, April, it seems some counties follow it well, give a good few games to their players. Some don't really follow it at all. And it's just that there doesn't seem to be any uniformity or continuity among any of the counties. And even if you are getting a few games in April, so be it, you might not actually end up playing another meaningful club match again for another few months.
Yeah, it seems like it's a constant saga between the players, the clubs, the association. I mean, Philip Lanigan is writing here, the problem for the CPA is that a player's strike may go unnoticed, as county championships look set to be delayed for months after the opening rounds are played during this month's club-only window situation, which is clearly heightened a sense of frustration amongst club players. So like you said, it seems like every season, like yourself, I'm sort of outside of the GAA beat as well, but it seems like every season there's a bit of friction between them and that the club players aren't being held. I even saw on Twitter the other day, was it Kildare? Someone had played a game during the week and this is supposed to be the club-only month, so there's clearly something broken along the line there, but how it's going to be resolved is beyond me anyway.
Yeah, and even it kind of, you know, I remember last week Gerry Thornley was writing about the frustration of club teams in rugby, and I found it, there seems to be similar teams there where the best players aren't getting the really good academy players for Munster, Leinster, Connacht and Ulster. They're not getting to play that much at all, whether it's for the Munster or Leinster A sides or anything like that. And also they're missing out then on the club action. And ultimately it's the clubs that are suffering, especially far out down the country.
Yeah, that's the bread and butter of, you know, Irish rugby. It's the same with the GAA, you know, the club game is so important to what we do here. And yeah, like you said, the rugby situation is a weird one. They're having that, you know, the American Cup that the A teams are going over playing at the moment at an absolutely crucial time in the All-Ireland League. So yeah, it's a bit, there's good parallels. They're actually similar, that the club players are the ones whose voice isn't being heard in all of this at all.
Yeah, that's your sports pages for the morning. We'll come back to a few more talking points a little bit later on. First, though, Alan Quinlan's going to join us on Skype Live from Limerick next here on OTBAM. First, though, here's Brian O'Driscoll on how he sees Munster getting on this weekend.
Saracens are the team to beat in the tournament. If they get Makovonopola back this week, which is there's a few question marks around it. Owen Farrell will be back. Remember, he wasn't involved in the quarterfinal demolition of Glasgow as of the birth of his first child. So I just think that is a mouth-watering prospect, because Munster are going to be at their dogged best, and whether they'll be able to contain the firepower that Saris have or not, I'm not sure, but...
Is their dogged best enough against Saracens? Because part of me looks at Munster and some of the performances, their biggest performances in the Champions Cup this season, they haven't played particularly well for an hour, but they've stuck in there, and then Keith Earls pops up with something special. Can you stick in there for an hour against Saracens?
But I think that's been their problem in the semi-finals over the last couple of seasons, is that the gulf between quarter-final and semi-final, they've been put away. But I think they're an improved side. Certainly, they were an improved side against Racing from the one against Saracens the previous season. I do think they'll be better for those experiences, but they're still going to have to produce their very best. And the firepower versus firepower, you back Saracens all day. But you know, something about Munster in Europe, and if they can hang in there and stay with Saracens, it's important not to concede early.
Very interesting there when Brian mentioned how much of an X factor and how important Keith Earls might be tomorrow. Obviously, this was recorded yesterday with Nathan before we knew that Earls was going to be missing out. It's just talk about timing.
Yeah, I think a lot of the papers have actually rightfully, you know, highlighted how important Keith Earls was going to be. But again, we'll see at 12 o'clock if it comes through. He might have made a miraculous recovery, but he would be a massive loss.
OK. Alan Quinlan is joining us live now from God's country, Limerick. Alan, 11 years ago, you were part of a Munster team that beat Saracens in the Ricoh Arena to get through to a Heineken Cup final. I can't imagine you thought back then, though, that this would be the last time Munster would be getting there for at least 11 years. Six semi-final defeats since then. It's been quite a while, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. There's been a lot of disappointments, Neil. Some happy memories. I was thinking about that this morning. The Ricoh Arena. That was a nervy enough performance for us that day against a Saracens side who we were fancied to beat. I think. Against all the odds, they nearly beat us, and we underperformed that day. And they're back to Coventry again. And unfortunately, as you said, Munster have had a fair few disappointments in semi-finals, losing six of them. I was just thinking about that in the last few days. Will their luck change? Are they good enough to make a change? I'm not sure. This is a game against. It's a completely different Saracen side, who were overwhelming favourites. They averaged 28 points a game in the pool stage. It's the only side to win all their pool games convincingly. So they average four tries a game as well. So you start thinking it's a different scenario than back in 2008. But, you know, Munster have a pedigree. It's their 14th semi-final. And, you know, you just wonder, will their luck change a little bit? Are they good enough is probably the more relevant question. And it's going to be a very, very difficult game for them, given the possibility of Keith Earls being missing now on top of Joey Carberry not going to be available.
Yeah, I was just going to say, like you mentioned, the Munster's luck potentially changing. It doesn't seem like it's going that way now over the last couple of days with the news that Keith Earls is probably going to miss out. Like, how big a blow is that going to be? We saw it against Edinburgh in the quarterfinal. Just two little snipes is all he got in pretty much the entire game. He was over for two tries. Like, a full-on game-breaker is what Keith Earls is, and to have him absent, that is massive.
Yeah, it is. It's usually disappointing for him if he doesn't play. Games like this, Neil, I think are you know, the small margins. You might get one or two line breaks. You might get a little opportunity, and you think someone like Keith Earls is the person who will create that or be on someone's shoulder if they make a line break and get a score. You know, I think both sides are very strong defensively, so there might be the opportunities might be limited. But, you know, he's a huge loss to miss him. And I think there's a lot of pressure on Tyler Blaindell to try and bring a big performance as well with Joey Carberry out. So you want kind of X-factor players who can create something out of nothing in big cup games. And Keith Earls and Joey Carberry are two guys that, unfortunately, Munster can ill afford to lose. But their attacking game this year hasn't been good enough, I don't think, at times. They were very good in Gloucester, I suppose, in round five. The performance in Exeter in round one was a real kind of show of steel and resilience and passion. So they have the capability going there. I think the worry is, where will the tries come from? Where will the scores come from?
Yeah, and like you mentioned there, you alluded to Saracens, like an average of 34 points and four tries in a game. Munster's attacking problems, they've the lowest number of, the lowest average metres per game of any side in the competition, even aside from teams that didn't even get through to the quarterfinals or the semifinals. So how do they go about, on one hand, narrowing all that down on Saracens' side and pushing everything out on their own side in attack?
I think for Munster to have any chance, they've got to frustrate Saracens, which is very difficult to do because they have so much power and so much quality throughout their team. So they've got to, you know, what's been good from this year is their defence. They've been the best defensive side in the pool stages. And so they've got to try and stay really, really connected in defence, not give up any soft scores and frustrate Saracens and maybe win a turnover or two from Tyke Byrne, from Stander, from O'Mahony. and get some energy and lifts out of that and play in the right areas and hope that they can force Saracens into a real dogfight and bring the intensity level up to a place maybe that Saracens may not be used to going. They're used to being the dominant side in most games they play. They've only lost 5 games this season. Some of those were in the Premier. They were in the Premiership when they were missing a number of their internationals. So they don't tend to lose games with their full strength side. So Munster have just got to be really, really efficient. They turned the ball over a number of times in that first half against Edinburgh and it nearly cost them. So they've got to be so much better. They'll know that themselves. I'm sure they've worked on it in the last few weeks. But they've just got to deliver an 8, 9, possibly some 10s out of 10 performances for the players and hope that they can just turn the tide a little bit on Saracens and put some pressure on them. But it's hard to see it happening, Neil. I know you want to see it happen. Keane wants to see it happen. I want to see it happen. But
we want to see it happen for the benefit of Irish rugby, Alan. No parochial biases or anything like that. For the benefit of Irish rugby.
How good would it be to have a Leinster-Munster final? It'd be incredible.
Absolutely. And,
I just think, look, they have a shot. You know what I mean? If I was in that dressing room, I'd be just thinking, right, we've got to throw everything at this. This isn't a game where they sit back. And 2 years ago, they sat back and they tried to slow the game down and they kicked the letter off the ball in the semi-final in 2017. Munster's biggest strength that I've seen the last number of years when they've played really well and dominated teams is when they hold on to the ball and they don't overcomplicate the game plan, but they can bring, you know, they can bring the number of phases into the 20s and that tires teams out and it has an effect. I know it's very attritional, but I think that's what they've got to do tomorrow. They need the work rate through the roof from the players and hope that they can just be really strong defensively and have a good set piece. So, and then if an opportunity too comes, that they take it. And, you know, if they were to get into a situation where they nudge themselves in front and they stay within touching distance or even ahead of Saracens going into the second half, well, then that belief and that confidence will start to grow. And there's a lot of big characters in that Munster side and there'll be a real hunger and a desire to try and compete. So part of me says, look, and the reality is most people say, look, Saracens are just too strong. But I just have a sense and a feeling that because Munster are not expected to win this game, that they might give it a real good crack.
They have to be brave, Quinny, don't they? I mean, you mentioned the game in 2017. I was watching it back during the week. It was kind of easy to forget because of the full-time scoreline, but Munster were only 6-3 down at half-time. But they didn't really fire a shot at all, did they? And you think about Saracens, they were probably in the dressing room going, we have you right where we want you now, because they just upped it in the second half then and pulled away from them. Munster have to fire a shot this time. You talk about Tyler Blaindall, a bit of a different type of out half to Joey Carberry, but I think he's going to have to take the ball to the line. I think someone like Chris Farrell is going to be absolutely vital. We've seen he can run through players, he can run over them, but he's also got the passing game, as we saw for the build-up to Keith Earls' try, second try in Edinburgh. So they're going to have to throw the ball around a little bit as well. Not get sucked into a mad Harry Carey game with Sarries, but they're going to have to be a little bit brave, aren't they?
Yeah, I think so. It's a very good point, Keane. They have to really go for this because there's no point in sitting in a dressing room afterwards thinking, look, we tried to contain them, keep the score down and hope that that we kept ourselves in it with 10 minutes to go and that I don't think that's gonna happen here. You've gotta try and play against good teams and how you do that is hold on to the ball yourself and be intelligent with what you're trying to do. I've no issue with them kicking because, you know, overplaying in their own half is going to force mistakes and put pressure on themselves. Just kicking intelligently and just forcing Saracens into mistakes and hope then that they can build a real tempo through their own team and match them physically. Saracens try to physically dominate teams. And so being brave isn't about throwing the ball all over the place. It's just having the ability and the confidence to maybe throw in an offload and just put pace and tempo into the game and try and instill a belief that if they get going, they're not going to get through this with a subpar performance. They need to, you know, really get it on the money here, everybody throughout the team. And look, they have a chance. It's very difficult. And bravery is probably something that you'd never question of a Munster team. But just intelligence and bravery together will certainly help them.
Yeah, Alan, you mentioned throwing the ball all around the place there a minute or so ago, and I think that brings us nicely to Toulouse against Leinster. Toulouse have just been an absolute joy to watch again. I don't know, is it just the age I am and the kind of era when I would have started really getting into rugby, but it just feels right to see a Toulouse team playing like this again.
Yeah, it's... I tell you, in round five, Neil, when they came to Dublin, there was a real sense of this Toulouse side can beat Leinster, and Leinster were missing a number of internationals, and they were on the back of an incredible run, Toulouse, and Leinster just out-muscled them on the day, frustrated the life out of them, held on to the ball so well, made very, very few mistakes, and just wore them out. And at the end of that game, I think when Adam Byrne goes in for the bonus point try, I thought, that's an incredible performance from Leinster. They just never give Dupont, Intermac, Ramos, any of these guys a sniff of the ball. And they were brilliant on the day. And they've got to do the same again on Sunday, because I think this Toulouse side has got better since that game. You could argue and say, well, look, it was a marker and this is Europe and it's different in the top 14. And this is where Leinster are at. And this is where you can win all the games you like in the top 14. But this is the real deal. And you had a sense of that after that game, that Leinster or Toulouse have got to go away, and Europe is just a different kettle of fish. But they've been brilliant and got better since. And I think one of the key things about this Toulouse side is they've got fitter together. Their skill set has improved. They've been blowing teams away. They've only lost one game against away to Toulon in the top 14 since that game. And they're the type of side who can be porous in defence, but their attack game is just through the roof. Their confidence, their belief, their counter-attacking game. And they kind of send out a message that, look, if you score, that's mine. We're just going to go up the field and score ourselves next. So Leinster have got to be very, very wary. And the issue for Leinster at the moment is they're undercooked together as a team. The worry is that can they just turn up on Sunday? Leo Cullen will pick a side of quality for sure, but they've got to get it right early on in the game and lay down a marker, because I think they nearly got caught against Ulster in that quarterfinal. They've got to be so much better against this Toulouse side, because they will create opportunities and they will probably learn from that game in round five.
Yeah, you mentioned the possibility of, you know, an undercooked Leinster. You know, they struggled maybe at times against Ulster a few weeks ago in the quarterfinal. I saw in the Irish Examiner this morning, Brendan O'Brien wrote that Leinster have used 44 players over the last three games. And, like, on one hand, it's fantastic. Their home semi-final in the Pro 14 wrapped up by the first week of March. But does it actually become a little bit difficult to manage the intensity and to manage the, I suppose, manage the ferocity of your performances when everything is sewn up that early in a season and just trying to maintain things?
Yeah, it's been a strange few weeks for Leinster, because it's very it's not normal that a team has secured a home semi-final so early in the, with so many rounds to go in the Pro 14. We'll know on Sunday evening whether that has helped them or not, because they're a side that like to be put under pressure. They like to keep that intensity within the group. And you could argue that maybe that intensity hasn't been there in the last few weeks, that high standard that we associate, no matter who plays for Leinster. That there's a real standard, and they've spoken about that over the years, many of their players. And, you know, the draw against Benetton is un-Leinster-like. The loss last week against Glasgow, un-Leinster-like. I know that there was no significance to the league. But just psychologically, I think Leo Cullen would have preferred to have Robbie Henshaw, Toner, Ringrose, Sexton, you know, all these guys playing last week and playing for 50 or 60 minutes and get him a hit out, given what happened in the quarterfinal. But that hasn't happened, that he's been able to get everybody out in the field. There's a number of changes again. So it is a concern. Are they good enough to turn up at the Aviva and get it right on Sunday? For sure they are. Mm-hmm. But they've got to start the game well. And if they give Toulouse any sort of confidence or self-belief, or let them get any sort of early scores in the game, it could be a difficult day for them.
Okay, Quinny, I know you have to go. Very quickly, though, two words. Who's your final? No explanation, just two teams.
Saracens, Leinster.
Okay, Quinny, you traitor. Get off the line.
No, I'm going to say...
Quinny, cheers for joining us. All the best. Enjoy the matches of the weekend. Look... as much as you might love to see Munster and Leinster, it is just hard to argue with just the sheer facts of it all. Saracens are the team to beat in this campaign, Keane, at the moment. And it's no disrespect to Munster to say that, Saracens probably are on paper big favourites at the very least.
No, they definitely are, and they're getting their players back at the right time. Like I mentioned earlier, you look at Owen Farrell coming back into the team. How many points was it? 50-odd they scored against Glasgow in the quarter-final without their chief playmaker, which is phenomenal. Mako Vunipola might be back. Brad Barrett is going to be back. It looks like he's a player who's massively important to what they do. So they're getting their big guys back. Munster are missing a couple of them, but like I was saying to Quinny there, the biggest thing for Munster is to fire a shot. They didn't do it last year in Bordeaux against Racing. They were nearly worse again at the Aviva against Saracens because it was such a negative game plan. Like Quinny was saying, they kicked the letter off the ball. So as long as they go out and fire a shot, I think they'll be happy with where they've got. Not that they'll be happy to lose in the semi-final, don't get me wrong, but as long as they show a better version of themselves.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we do have a few more rugby stories to get to this morning. First, though, here's Brian O'Driscoll on Leinster against Toulouse this Sunday.
It would be difficult viewing for Leinster as well, in that they got outplayed for large parts of that game. So they'll feel that they've used up their get out of jail card and that they won't get a second bite with the Toulouse team. I went over and saw their semi final in the La Défense Arena, and they were sublime. So Toulouse are well and truly back.
The performance levels then against Ulster, do you put that down to just an off day, or simply that Leinster can't get to the level they want if they don't have Toner, Sexton, Henshaw on the pitch?
The best teams are Barcelona ever as good without Messi? Mm. No, they're not.
So which one of them is Messi?
the amalgamation of the three of them, combines something that the great players, in football or any sport, bring. And the comfort that seeing a Dev Toner, seeing a Robbie Henshaw, seeing a Johnny Sexton in the team sheet, for all the other players, the comfort that brings, it's an intangible, where immediately confidence is higher. I looked at that Leinster team in the quarterfinal and I saw a vulnerability for the first time. They're playing Sean O'Brien at seven, but ordinarily if Josh van der Fleer and Dan Levy were fit, would he be getting in the team? Possibly not. Mm. So it's mad that we're talking about, a Sean O'Brien who 2 years ago was absolutely brilliant in the Lions.
He's got to take one of these chances.
Because opportunities have been taken away from others through injury. So, I think Leinster will feel as though they've managed to navigate their way through. They know they don't have a second chance.
Yeah, that's Brian O'Driscoll there talking about Leinster's chances against Toulouse on Sunday. Another part of that team news we mentioned Keith Earls missing. For Leinster, though, it looks like Jameson Gibson-Park is going to be out. Mm. That makes Leo Cullen's decision for him over, is it James Lowe, Jameson Gibson-Park or Scott Fardy?
Yeah, because there was some suggestion earlier in the week that it might actually be Gibson-Park and Fardy who get it, which it would have been incredible to think again that James Lowe would miss out. And the one thing about if that had happened is you're having your two overseas signings on the bench, to leave out a game breaker like James Lowe. And geez, it must be tough. Those conversations that Leo Cullen must have with those guys must be extremely tough because they are all meritorious, worth their place in the squad.
Obviously, and players who probably would walk into most other starting 15s.
Absolutely. And the thing about Gibson Park is, though, he becomes Irish qualified in June. Yeah. So obviously for next season, this won't be an issue. Yeah. I think the Scott Fardy was probably always going to play anyway because he's just such an important player. But with Mick Kearney and Ross Maloney ruled out, that kind of made that part of the decision. So in one way, maybe Leo Cullen, it makes it a little bit easier that his hand is forced, but I think everyone wants to see James Lowe playing at the weekend, don't they? We haven't seen enough of him this season. We've barely seen him since he got sent off actually in Thomond Park over Christmas, so I'm sure he'll be itching to get out there and prove a point on the big stage as well.
Are Leinster as good as they were 12 months ago?
No. I don't think they are. I mean, I think they were so good last season, and you look at the calibre of players they lost, Easton Asewa, Joey Carberry, Jordy Murphy, who his worth has been proven, I think, since he's left, because see how well he's playing for Ulster, and he's right back in the World Cup frame now with the injuries. I don't think they are as good, but that's not to say they're not good, if you know what I mean. They were at such a peak last season, but for them to drop down, they could still do the double again this year, and I don't think anyone would be surprised. But you kind of forget that when Toulouse beat them over in Toulouse, that Leinster threw two intercepts that resulted in tries. So I think they'll be mindful of that as well. They absolutely, Quinny was mentioned there, they smothered them at the RDS. And I thought Toulouse were really disappointing that day, but they're better than what they were in January as well. I think, is it 2 defeats in 23 games? And they had that mad game against Claremont at the weekend, which it looked great, and the razzle-dazzle was kind of similar to the quarter-final against Racing, but will that work against a Leinster side? I don't know. Toulouse have plenty of firepower, but I think they'll offer up chances. I think Reggie Saunders actually is worth a mention.
Yeah, you're writing about him as well, aren't you?
Yeah, he's a really interesting fella. He spent 3 years in Bandon in West Cork, and there's just been this horde of Munster players who've come through in the last couple of years. He likes Finney and Witcherly, his younger brother Josh, who just won the under-20s Grand Slam. Very exciting prop coming through. The Coombs cousins, Gavin, Liam. So West Cork rugby has really been on the rise. But basically, Reggie Saunders, a former flanker for Toulouse, came over and he wanted to take a step back. He came from Bordeaux, step back from the sort of demanding professional environment. And he went in and he worked in Bandon RFC and he worked in Bandon Grammar, which I don't know if you've seen as well, the Munster schools, like, yeah, they're on the up as well. So
was it last year or the year before?
Yeah, I think it was year four. He did an incredible job, but he was so laissez-faire when he was walking around with his beret and his Crocs around.
Yeah,
West
there Park. there was that great photo as well of him walking into the RDS this year before the Leinster game. Yeah. And just beret, Crocs, yeah, holding his cup of coffee.
You can imagine him walking around the streets abandoned like that. But it's a great story, because when he arrived, I was writing about it in the paper, we were chatting to Richie Gray during the week about him, and the people at West Cork couldn't believe that they got a guy of this calibre. Like, I mean, he was in demand by the top European clubs, which was proven when Toulouse paid a lot of money to get him back.
To get him back, yeah.
Yeah, so, the point about it is, he has brought a bit of an edge to that Toulouse pack, and that's what Richie Gray was saying, that, you know, he's from Toulouse, he played for Toulouse, he gets what the culture is about, and that's been a big part of it. You look at Hugo Mola, Clement Poitrinault, and William Servat, obviously all former top players at Toulouse, and they're all on the coaching staff now, and that's been a big part of the renaissance of Toulouse. And Reggie Saunders has brought that real hard edge to the pack. I think they're 100% in their set piece, their scrum.
100% in scrums. I think they're, did I take it down here, they are in, I think they're second for lineouts. Saracens are first.
Like, that's pretty good going, and especially for a French team. And what he was saying was that he drills them a lot, and it's a lot of repetition, whereas the stuff you hear about French rugby is it's not like that. It's way more relaxed. So that makes them an even more dangerous proposition. But I guess the people in West Cork can sort of half claim Reggie Saunders.
One thing we actually haven't really spoken about at all, and it's a story that would have come out probably just after the lads would have been finished yesterday on OTBAM, but Rory Best confirmed he is going to retire fully after the World Cup in Japan. It was something you were talking about when you came into the office this morning, how, you know, it was unofficially confirmed probably for the last few months, but it wasn't until yesterday when we had the official line that it was going to happen in the press conference. And you know, you were saying you were actually, given that it was a poorly kept secret probably over the last few months, you thought it was surprising just how emotional Rory got yesterday.
Yeah, it was funny. I actually did an interview with him over the phone last Friday that hasn't been published yet, and I didn't really go too much into it because he's been asked so much about it. But he dropped loads of hints that it was coming, and it was fairly obvious. But I wouldn't say he was emotionless, but there wasn't much emotion in what he was saying. He was very comfortable. Again, it was over the phone, but yeah, yesterday when he sat down and the cameras were on, I was really taken aback by really how hard it hit him. Even for the first question, he was barely able to, you know, speak, which I thought it was great to see. It showed how much it meant to him. And this is a guy who's obviously the captain of Ireland, and he does a lot of press conferences for the captain's run, and he's just such a steady hand. He never really, you know, shirks anything. He's always positive in what he says. But yeah, it took me by surprise. It was good to see. He brought up his brother as well, and the conversations that he had with him, and I think that reminded him of, you know, how special it was to get a chance to play with him. But look, he's had an incredible career, hasn't he? He was sort of saying to me that the last couple of years he has really felt it in his body, you know, and that in a few years' time he wants to actually...
Tim Lydon out there, you can see it on the screen, alongside his brother Simon.
Picture, yeah.
Simon would have been forced to retire in 2008. It was actually in a regular heartbeat in the end that forced Simon Best to retire.
Yeah, I was just saying he's one of those players who kind of you haven't really seen or heard much from him.
Yeah.
But Best was saying that he's been feeling it. You know, he said he doesn't like to show it, but he has been feeling it in his body. And you look at it, he's got, I think, three young kids. and you look at the way he plays the game, he hasn't changed really his style of play. He still goes in for the jackals, and you see how, you know, it's such a controversial topic at the moment, but he's conscious, I think, of, you know, in the next years he wants to be able to play with his young kids, and this is important. So yeah, the World Cup is just a fitting ending, isn't it? You know, the Ireland captain hopefully going out on a high.
Is he a lock for a starting place in Japan?
I still think so. It's definitely debatable. I think if Niall Scannell was to have an outstanding game tomorrow and Munster were to win and go on to win the Champions Cup, I think the debate might be get a bit more heated. But yeah, I think so. For me, he is he's not the same player he was, but he's such a massive leader. Obviously, his line-out throwing can be an issue, but to make such a big change at this stage, so close to the World Cup, I think wouldn't really be in Schmidt's sort of, you know, makeup. But then again, maybe he might surprise us all. But yeah, I think best main focus now is to make sure he gets back for Ulster's run-in, which he is hoping to do, I think.
Mm-hmm. Also as well, Ronan O'Gara writing this morning in the Irish Examiner. One little small snippet actually to take out of it. He's writing about how he's away in Fiji having a little break at the moment. The Crusaders are on a bye week in the in Super Rugby at the moment. But he's saying that pretty much this rumoured move for him to France in the World Cup probably doesn't look like it's going to happen now. One of the things I promised with this column is keeping it factual. So while there's been a lot of speculation in recent weeks about me going to the World Cup as part of a French backroom team, I did say all along there was nothing concrete to report, and so it has proved. I had conversations with senior people in the FFR, and I was interested in a detailed proposition, but the conversation never got to that point, to the bit where a specific role working with specific people was on the table. I've heard no more in recent weeks, so I can assume it's off the table now. No surprise, really, that the move fell apart because the French Rugby Federation couldn't provide enough details, really, or enough of a plan.
Yeah, and in fairness, you got to love Ronan O'Gara and how he handles himself in the media. I know he was on here with the lads and Off the Ball, and he's always so honest. I mean, this is what he has said from day dot about this whole saga, and the French press had it that he was close to signing.
Just love how this wasn't like a big story. It's just kind of like thrown in midway through a column.
It's kind of classic his style, isn't it? I saw him, he was doing with the lads the other day, chatting from Fiji, like, you know, just off the beach. But I think he's played this very, very well. If he had gone in there, it was kind of a shot to nothing. If it had gone well, it'd gone well, but it wouldn't have damaged his reputation. But he's still sitting pretty in one of the most sought after jobs at the Crusaders. And, you know, the talk over there in New Zealand is that Scott Robertson could be another honorary Irishman, actually, who obviously spent time in Ulster, but he could be the next All Blacks coach. And if he gets the next All Blacks coach, and they seem to have a really good relationship, O'Gara and Robertson, you never know, O'Gara could end up there. Which, so his career trajectory as a player was just always on the way up, and as a coach, it's been no different. It's brilliant to watch.
He's obviously done all his work outside of Ireland, racing onto Crusaders, and who knows from here. Himself and Paul O'Connell are always being talked about. Anytime there's a sniff of any kind of a coaching vacancy in Ireland, their names are being thrown in. Let's get them back. Let's bring them back over here. Is it not better in the long run, probably for Irish rugby and for the two of them, to stay out of the bubble for as long as possible? Because in the grand scheme of things, in terms of coaches, they're still young men. They still have there's potentially 20, 30 years of coaching still to go. To stay outside of the Irish rugby bubble and to learn as much as you can about various different countries, about rugby cultures, and bring it all back then at a later date. I just kind of wonder a little bit, what's the rush in bringing them back? As good as they might be when they come back, you know.
I suppose you're seeing...
Let them learn more.
Yeah, I suppose you're seeing two different sides of that, because O'Gara certainly is doing that over the last few years. But you look at Paul O'Connell now, he's leaving Stade at the end of the season a year early, and that's a move that didn't work out at all. Apparently, like, you know, Heineke Meyer, the former Springbok coach, calls all the shots there. It's been very difficult, by all accounts, you know, to get his stamp on the team. Heineke Meyer picks the team, doesn't always do the training with the forwards, so I think it's been very frustrating. Yeah, I think there's a point in that, but O'Connell still hasn't committed himself to, you know, that he's going to be involved with coaching. On O'Gara, I'd love to be a fly on the wall in the IRFU offices, that when they're possibly in line for a new attack coach, although there's some suggestion that Andy Farrell might actually take on more of a role as attack coach, would be very interesting. But when the IRFU are looking at one of their former players who will, let's face it, end up back here eventually, I wonder, are they going, OK, when is the time to pull the trigger and just get him back? Because when you see like the Crusaders, the type of rugby they play, and he has a massive hand in what they're doing. Some of the rugby that they play, the best rugby in Super Rugby. So, yeah, he's going to come back eventually. It's just a matter of time and when the RFU, I think, pull the trigger. It'd be interesting to see over the next few months, because obviously his contract's up at the end of the Super Rugby season. So he's going to be available technically unless he signs on again.
We're almost finished on rugby. One little quick thing we're going to bring up. Both of us spotted us this morning. This is in The Independent. It's a syndicated column from Austin Healy ahead of this weekend. Steady Blaindell may just be a better fit for Carberry than Carberry for Saracens tie. Before we go into it, let's hear what Austin Healy had to say on BT Sport back in January 2019.
Probably better than Sexton, and if he could start for Ireland against England in that first opening Six Nations game, that'd be perfect.
So that was Joey Carberry. Probably better than Sexton. Now, though, he's out. Tyler Blaindell. Do you know what? He's a better fit.
Yeah, it's a classic flip-flop there, isn't it? I think I can kind of see... The point he was making was that Blaindell is a bit more of a controlling 20-10, which is fair enough. But I still think you need the bit of, you know, the game-breaking ability against the Saracens. It goes back to what we talked about firing a shot. Now, Blaindell is more than capable of doing it, but Joey Carberry has much more pace. He'll take the ball to the line much more aggressively. So I think that was his point. But, yeah, it's an interesting flip-flop after basically saying that...
we'll be fair to Healy. Like, he does qualify. He says Blaindell may actually suit Munster better for a game like this. He understands the game plan, kicks well and can move sides around. That becomes more of a threat against a team like Saracens, who are so well-drilled defensively, that it's going to be a tactical manoeuvre that beats them rather than a piece of individual magic and a lot of fighting spirit. And in fairness to him, look, he does absolutely sing the praises of Joey Carberry throughout that. Time to move on at the moment. It's time for last chance, actually, for our competition, our brilliant competition, with thanks to Turkish Airlines, proud sponsors of Cricket Ireland. Here on OTBAM, we're giving you the chance to fly anywhere that Turkish Airlines go to enter. All you have to do is head over to offtheball.com and fill in the entry form at the moment. Winner will be announced just before 9 o'clock this morning, so around the end of the show. It really is your very, very, very last chance to enter. It's all to celebrate a massive summer of cricket for Ireland. Ireland is facing the busiest summer of cricket we've ever known, hosting some of the biggest teams in the world, England, the West Indies, Bangladesh. Cricket Ireland are also hosting Zimbabwe and Afghanistan later in the summer. And on the 3rd of May, the Irish team will face England in Malahide with a tri-series against Bangladesh and the West Indies to follow. Turkish Airlines are the proud sponsors of the Ireland men's cricket team to celebrate the renewal of this partnership for a further 2 years. They're giving away a fantastic prize of a pair of flight tickets to anywhere in their network. So get on to offtheball.com to enter that as soon as possible. We are going to turn to football next. Daniel Harris will be joining us to look ahead at a massive weekend of Premier League action. First, though, we can hear from Kenny Cunningham, who was talking about Man City and Liverpool and the title race.
The sounds of it, then, they may actually have to be quite busy in the transfer market, because you look at last night and you do wonder as well whether that would have happened if Fernandinho was playing and the protection he might have been able to give the back four. And Fernandinho's 33 at this stage. It doesn't seem as though they have a like-for-like replacement. Is that an area as well, that centre midfield where Gundogan played last night, very different type of footballer to Fernandinho, where they need some sort of backup?
Yeah, I think so. I think this will really hurt Guardiola. No matter what he comes out publicly and says, that result last night could almost be a little bit of a watershed in terms of, I've spoken about kind of the centre-halves, even Mendy at left-back. Fernandinho, you're absolutely correct. A couple of players who can play in there. You could argue even Kevin De Bruyne playing in the holding midfield position is good enough to do it in possession of football, getting the ball and getting a Manchester City up the pitch. But of course, the defensive side of his game wouldn't be the strongest. Gundogan as well, he was probably a little bit more efficient defensively than De Bruyne, but certainly hasn't got the presence of Fernandinho on that holding midfield position. So you're absolutely right. He could go and spend big in terms of centre-half holding midfield. And even that left-back position in the summer, that would be big money. But I think it's something which he has to do, because, generally speaking, football, the very highest level, any of those kind of small frailties, even in a team as good as Manchester City, you do get found out. And it's in those areas of the pitch that we're speaking about that ultimately have cost Manchester City on occasion on the very big stage. You look at Liverpool, for example, and I look at the setup of their team, the defensive setup of their team, I don't see those weaknesses. And it's why I've always felt Liverpool have the edge over Manchester City in the league for quite some time now. Just that kind of defensive resilience across the defensive line, the protection they get in those central midfield areas. For me, Liverpool are a team who can sit in, and soak up pressure and probably defend better in 1v1 situations as well than that kind of Manchester City defensive lineup. So, yeah, it'll be intriguing to see how Guardiola sees it, and also between now and the end of the season, how that championship runoff plays out between Manchester City and Liverpool, and see who falters, and whichever team does, what are the reasons why they do falter? Because Manchester City lose out again, I think it'll be for the same reasons that we're talking about, why they've missed out in the semi-final for the Champions League as well.
Okay, Daniel Harris is joining us on the line now. Good morning, Daniel.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
Thank you.
We'll get to Manchester City and Liverpool a little bit later on, because it's another massive weekend in the title race. I think every weekend for the last few weeks has been and will be for the next month or so as well. But there was a story that we just touched on when we were going through our paper round this morning on the back of the Sun. It's Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has apparently launched into a few of his big names after the 3-0 defeat at the Nou Camp the other night. I don't know, would you have seen any of it in the papers this morning? But it probably would have been warranted, I think, maybe with some of the performance. I think he questioned the attitude of a few of them, that they weren't giving 100%. Is Ole Gunnar Solskjaer starting to really just discover what it's like now being the permanent manager as opposed to being the stand-in, as opposed to being the nice guy who's here just for a few months?
I'm not sure about that. I think when you hear him talk about United, it seems quite clear that he spent quite a lot of time before he got the United job watching United play. So he probably had a fairly good idea of what he was coming to discover. And it went unexpectedly well at the beginning, but I don't think anyone's surprised. I'm certainly not surprised that he's had to have these kind of conversations, because I think that you've got players who do that a certain level of mental fortitude, and they're not reliable. You can't rely on their effort and you can't rely on their quality. So the fact that a manager's having to have those conversations is not surprising. I think the only surprising thing is that it's taken so long for them to be necessary.
Yeah, 5 defeats and 7 now at the moment. Like, are you worried at all about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer?
No, not really.
I'm not suggesting he's going to be, like, you know, sacked in 2 weeks' time or anything like that if they lose a couple of games. But you're not really that overly worried with the signs you're seeing on the pitch. You know, you're expecting maybe a lot of changes in the summer.
I would say that the chances are he's not the right man for the job, because there are very few people existing in the world who could do this job and succeed at it, I think. And things that are too good to be true generally are too good to be true. Seems unlikely. You can be a high-level player for United, then turn up having managed Mould and Cardiff and be a great manager. But I think that what's happening at the moment is inevitable, because if United carried on as they were doing for the first few months when Solskjaer was the manager, you'd be getting championship form out of them. And this is not a championship team. So I think it was inevitable that there was going to be a drop. And if you look at the games they've lost, I would be more inclined to say, well, which games do I think that they've been beaten in, when I think those were the fault of the manager rather than the fault of the players not being good enough? I'm not sure that this team, however any manager arranges it, is going to be able to go to the Nou Camp and get a result. I felt like the cup game against Wolves, Solskjaer picked the wrong team, rushing back too many players from injury. And when it wasn't going United's way, he didn't change it in time. Against Arsenal, Lukaku missed an empty net almost from 4 yards out. I don't think that's on Solskjaer. The finishing against Wolves in the league also, United should have had that game gone, finished, well before they lost the game. And again, looked like Solskjaer picked the right team that night, picked the right tactics, and the players didn't execute them properly. They played quite well, but in the end, they weren't ruthless. And I don't think that that is on Solskjaer either. So it's easy to say, well, this is Solskjaer's fault, he's not got enough experience. But if the same people who are saying that are also agreeing that the players aren't good enough, then what do they expect? So I think that the scale of the job is becoming more apparent. But at the same time, there are some good players there, and players who playing in a good team would probably be quite good. What he needs is he needs to find players this summer to elevate that, players who can actually make a not such a good team a good team. And he doesn't have a lot of margin for error, because he won't get given enough money to be able to waste any of it.
Yeah, you mentioned finding players has to be important. Is it even more important to find those players to play a little bit closer to your own goal than the opposition's?
I'm actually not sure about that. In that, obviously, United could do with some better centre-backs. Of course they could. But if you had a better midfield, you'd find the centre-backs had quite a lot less work to do. And if you look, for example, at Manchester City, if you gave their centre-backs the amount of work that Smalling and Lindelof have to do, I think you'd see that they conceded quite a lot more goals. And similarly, if you put City's midfield in front of Smalling and Lindelof, you would find that they look more solid because they would have less to do. So I think that what United really need is they need two midfield players who are going to enable them to control the game. Because at the moment, United are unable to control games against midfield, even against kind of good Premier League teams like Leicester, never mind the better Premier League teams, and then never mind the better teams in Europe. So I would say that if you sort the midfield out, then you would immediately create more chances, keep the ball more, and protect the defence better. And those would be the key elements of the team that I would say you have to improve whatever happens. If they end up signing a better centre-back, then that would be good, but it definitely isn't where I would start.
Yeah, looking ahead, we'll move on, I suppose, like, you know, towards the title race. Liverpool and Man City both in action this weekend. Liverpool, they're away to Cardiff on Sunday. Before that, Man City will have the chance to get back above Liverpool and, you know, move level on 34 games played as well when they take on Spurs tomorrow. Just a few days after that incredible game at the Etihad the other night, I can't for the life of me see how we're going to get anything even close to that tomorrow morning.
No, I would expect not. I mean, I would expect that City will win that game quite comfortably because, I mean, both teams need the points, but and both teams will be on the come down, but City will probably be fired with some level of injustice and they're just a better team. So I would expect them to get it done. But I was surprised because I was surprised that Spurs got past City, but also I was surprised that Spurs got past City by playing how they played. And this isn't particularly a criticism of Spurs because half the team that played weren't fit and without Harry Kane as well, and they still found a way to get it done. But it didn't seem like they got past City by outplaying them or by out-tacticking them. It's just because football is a chaotic game and City made mistakes at the wrong moment, and sometimes those things happen. If City play anything like the way they played on Wednesday night, they'll win quite comfortably. But then if they'd have played anything like that in the first leg, they would have won the tie quite comfortably. So you can never exactly predict what's going to happen, but I think that City will be okay in that one.
So if City and Liverpool both win all of their games between now and the end of the season, it's City who win the title. Even still, would you still make City the favourites overall? Like, they do have the tougher run in Spurs tomorrow and Man United coming on Wednesday.
I think it's marginal now. I mean, yeah. I've been sitting here all season saying City will win the league and probably by a few points because they're much better than Liverpool. And I mean, I guess I still think that City's best is way better than Liverpool's best, but Liverpool have done a phenomenal job. And I think in the end, you've got to look at it and admire what Jurgen Klopp's done, because when you look at Liverpool's players and if you just look at their 1-11, you kind of wonder how it works, in that Van Dijk is obviously an elite level player and the three forwards are really good. Although if you had free reign to go and buy any of the forwards in the world, you wouldn't be taking any of theirs. And what that tells you is Jurgen Klopp has worked out a blend. He's worked out a team that works from front to back, and he's also worked out a team that works in partnerships. So the front three work. You get enough goals out of them, and you generally get enough goals at the right time. And he's got a midfield that protects the defence and gets enough of the ball to those players, despite the fact that when you actually look at that midfield, in whatever configuration of Keita, Wijnaldum, Milner, Henderson it is, somehow it's working, and that is all on Jurgen Klopp, really. And you can only admire what he's done. So to start saying Liverpool are going to lose games to crap teams at this point, I mean, I've been waiting for that to happen most of the season, and it hasn't happened. So they don't look nervous now. Sort of at the end of January, at the beginning of February, when they dropped points to West Ham, they dropped points to Leicester, those weren't good performances that the chaotic nature of football somehow turned into draws. Those were performances of a team that is going for a title and is nervous, and you can feel the crowd getting nervous. But I think mainly thanks to Sadio Mane on the pitch, who was the one who stood up at that point, they've managed to turn it around. And now Liverpool, even when they've been chasing games, when they chased the game against Tottenham, they weren't doing so in a frantic way. They were doing so in an intense way, but in a controlled way, like a team that knew they were going to score. And also against Chelsea, when they were 0-0 at half-time, that is an opportunity to get nervous, and they didn't take it. They were cold and they were furious, and they managed to get it done. So I would expect Liverpool to win their games, but then I would expect City to win their games as well, because they're significantly better than all the teams they're playing. I guess history tells us that someone will drop points somewhere, because it's unusual for one team even to go on a winning run to end the season, never mind two. But if I was betting, I would marginally be betting on City, but generally I'd be staying out of that.
Yeah, you mentioned the mentality there at Liverpool, which I kind of found really, really interesting, because I'd say it was probably a couple of months ago, I can't remember exactly, they played Crystal Palace and we would have done live commentary of that game that day. And I remember all of us remarking, just like, even our commentary team were saying it, just the atmosphere around Anfield, every single person was so on edge. It was so tense. The players on the pitch looked nervous, the fans looked nervous, and we were thinking, how in the name of God are we going to do this for another two and a half months? But it just kind of seems that the longer it's going on, they're just getting used to it. The fans don't seem to be as on edge or as nervous. The players seem to be a lot more comfortable and controlled, even when they are chasing a game when they might be level, or you know, when they were behind against Southampton a few weeks ago. It seems that they're kind of growing into the title race a little bit more from a mental side of things.
Yeah, I would agree with that. They've got used to the pressure, and I guess in a way, as a player, this is why you play. These are the days of your lives. If you can't enjoy the level of tension, then you're in the wrong sport, really, and in the wrong profession. And they've started to look like they're enjoying it, and they started to look like they believe that it's going to happen for them. And it doesn't matter if destiny is a load of nonsense, if people buy into it, because once people start believing in those things, it gives them the freedom to go and perform. And that's what we've seen from Liverpool. And what we look about Liverpool is there's no area of their team at the moment that you could say isn't functioning. They've had the problem of creativity from midfield all season. And I mean, you can see why Klopp wanted to sign Fekir in the summer. But actually, at the moment, they appear to have found some level of solution to that might not be a long-term solution of playing Jordan Henderson further forward. But for now, it's working. And it doesn't need to work for that much longer. And when you look at their fixtures, Newcastle away, Newcastle will make it difficult and it might be tight for a bit. But in the end, the class will probably tell. So if City do drop points, what it will probably come down to is whether they bottle that last game against Wolves, because the weight of the pressure of 29 years is upon them. But otherwise, it's hard to see them dropping points. But you never quite know what will happen with injuries or what will happen. They've got to play Barcelona twice. So there is still quite a lot of football to happen. And you should never assume that because a team's playing well at one moment, it will be playing well at the next moment, never mind a few moments down the road, because football teams have 11 players in them. That's a lot of moving parts. So momentum is hard to gain and easy to lose. But at the moment, they're looking very strong. And as I said, like, Jurgen Klopp's done a phenomenal job in making that happen, because they've stayed with City all the way. And that's not easy to do. City are also a team that is very grooved and honed. And so in order to stay with them, you have to get a lot of points. And that's really why I thought Liverpool would fall down. If it was a low points tally, then it's easier for an inferior team to win the league. And I don't think that Liverpool are as good as City, but they've managed to find a way to keep beating everyone else. And you can only congratulate them for that.
To go back to Spurs and Man City the other night as well, I would have seen you talk about VAR a lot over the last year or so on Twitter, and how you would have said it kind of takes the joy out of the moment of being a football fan, you know, when that ball hits the net and all of a sudden now you're kind of wondering, is it a goal, is it not a goal, is it a penalty, is it this or that, is it a red card? Has the last few couple of months, maybe a Champions League, has that just reinforced your opinion of it, or has the incredible number of VAR moments we've had, has it changed at all?
No, not really. I guess for me, like, when your team scores, that is not just the greatest moment in football. That's the greatest moment you get to experience in your life on a regular basis. No offense to my wife and daughter, but I understand the difference. But
so what? Like, just a goal against Fulham in a 3 o'clock game to go 2-0 up. That is better than being a married man and having a kid.
I don't know. Yeah. That crucial goal, obviously, is the greatest feeling that exists. Like, you never experience spontaneous ecstasy like that, really, in any other environment, in any other circumstance in your life. And I personally wouldn't sacrifice that for anything. And for people watching at home, obviously, it does increase the drama. But I think it's funny, because the VAR decision at the end, it's the Sterling goal that was ruled out for offside. That, to me, is in some ways shows you the best side of VAR, and the other side shows you the worst of VAR, because it's the best of VAR in that the decision was a howler, and that's the kind of the catchphrase that people always talk about in cricket. where they say that the point of DRS is to eliminate the howler. And I felt like that's what VAR did there. But on the other hand, it felt like that was that Sterling one. When Aguero was offside, it didn't need backwards and forwards. It didn't need lines on the screen.
Yeah.
It was a really clear offside. So it was quite a significant error, I thought, by the officials. And actually one where you think, lads, you should actually be spotting that first time. Obviously, you want the referees to get the decisions correct, but no one fell in love with football because the standard of decision-making was correct. Sometimes decisions are correct and sometimes decisions are incorrect. And if you're an adult, you should be able to put that behind you quite quickly because it's not real life, it's football. So for me, it doesn't really alter. I don't feel better about football when the referees make correct decisions. So, I mean, VAR personally has actually enriched my life quite significantly this year because my team beat PSG thanks to VAR, and I now don't need to worry because for the rest of this season because the treble that my team won is safe for another year. But I wouldn't have had any complaints if City had gone through with an offside goal because sometimes it happens and you move on and you forget about it. So I haven't really changed my opinion about VAR because I just find the whole thing quite strange and spooky and artificial, and I'm not invested in officials getting correct decisions. I'm invested in the emotion and flow of the game much more. But I understand why people like VAR. So yeah, I wouldn't call someone anything for liking VAR. But for me, it doesn't turn me on.
Hey Daniel, how are things? Do you think we'll ever get to a point with VAR where maybe you can hear what the VAR officials essentially are saying? Because I think as a viewer, it's such a strange experience when you're watching it on TV and, you know, it pops up on the screen at the stadium before you know at home, you know, what's actually going on. Do you think we'll ever get to a position where we can get an insight into what the officials are saying to each other?
It's weird, isn't it? Because at the moment, I think the first thing they have to do in that regard is allow spectators to see the action, but they're still kind of sort of stuck in the 70s and 80s that somehow if a decision is contentious or right or wrong, then there'll be a riot. Yeah. And it's a load of nonsense, but I think that would prevent it from us from being able to hear. I mean, we might get there in the end, but I think the first step is to put that stuff on the screen. And once they do that, then it's probably eventually we'll be able to hear what the officials are saying. Although football crowds are quite noisy. It would be quite hard to be able to do that in the cacophony. And I think officials presumably would like that not to happen because they're risk-averse conservative types who would be worried that somehow they would say the wrong thing. Or there would be something that wouldn't quite work. But yeah, I mean, I think that once it's already happening, and it is already happening, and we're not going back the other way, then you need to make it as comprehensive as possible and as spectator-friendly as possible. And that is definitely part of it. So I would agree that is something that would be sensible. But I think that until we're allowed to see what's actually going on, it won't happen.
Okay, Daniel, thanks for joining us this morning and we'll speak to you again soon.
See you, lads. Bye.
Take care. Just a reminder as well, a lot of live Premier League coming up across our Off The Ball channels this weekend. Tomorrow on Today FM on Premier League Live at Sky Sports, there's a double show on. The first part of that is going to be online. So if you go to todayfm.com/PLL at 12:15 tomorrow, you can hear live and exclusive commentary of Manchester City against Spurs from the Etihad Stadium. And when the show starts at 2 o'clock then on the FM, we'll bring you all the rest of the action from the Etihad, as well as West Ham against Leicester at 3 o'clock. And then on Sunday on News Talk on Off The Ball from 1 p.m. in the afternoon, I'll be with you that afternoon and we will have commentary of Everton against Manchester United. That's at 1:30. Stephen Doyle and Alan Stubbs will be on commentary there. And then it's over to Liverpool to see if maybe they might be going back above Man City at the top. Maybe they'll be extending their lead at the top. They are away to Cardiff. Ian Beach and Alan McLaughlin will be on commentary there. Cian, final thoughts before we leave you go. What way do you lean when it comes to football?
Oh, big fan. Yeah, absolutely big fan. The VAR thing was interesting the other night because obviously I was kind of touching on what happens in rugby with the TMO because I think that adds to the tension. And, you know, at the Six Nations games, you get the ref mics and then at the other games, you don't. And you realise how important it is. And I know what Daniel was saying, OK, it's different crowds and things like that. But it's very unfair, I think, to especially to the people who are at the games who are paying.
Like, because for the most part, they don't even know. It's not even that. Like, they don't even know what is being checked. They don't know, is it an offside? Is it a handball? Is it a penalty? Is it a potential red card? All they know is the game is stopped and the referee is checking something.
Yeah, and then you're forced to get out your phone, aren't you, at a live event and get on Twitter and whatever, which should not be the case if you're the one at the game experiencing it. But I don't know, I kind of... Sometimes I'm all for VAR and sometimes I agree with Daniel that that sort of euphoric moment, you know, you're missing that. But when you're getting the decisions correct, I think, you know, especially in such big games, it takes away that whole debate about, oh, was it on or offside, should have been allowed. But, yeah, no, I think the going down the route, something like rugby with the TMO, if VAR is here to stay, which it obviously looks like it is, then they're going to have to do something like that. Because it does add to the tension as well. You know, you've been at plenty of rugby games as well when they're checking a try in the corner or something. It adds to the tension. And at the moment in football, I feel like that's kind of lost because you don't know what's going on. And it's actually the people at home who are more engaged, which shouldn't be the case for a live event.
And when it comes to a team, what way do you lean?
I've said my allegiances.
I'll put it to you this way. Who's going to win the title?
Well, I can't say Man United, so that might give you a clue. I still think City. I think the thing about Liverpool is the conditioning of their players is phenomenal, considering the amount of rotation Pep does with City. And I know he's coming for criticism for De Bruyne not starting in the first leg, but these Liverpool players have played so many games this season and they don't look like slowing down. I think City, though, having been knocked out of Europe, that they're going to be like fuming. So I'd imagine that they might sneak it, but it's going to be cracker. Hopefully it does come down to the final day.
Yeah, it's going to be brilliant. I had someone during the week on Twitter thinking I was a Liverpool fan. I had to correct him very quick. I'm not going to say who I support, but it's I'm not a Liverpool fan.
You made me out myself as a United fan, but you're not going to...
I did. You outed yourself. I left that window open. You could have just not said anything. Before we go, though, a quick word on predictions. We've had a poll running, actually, this morning on our Off the Ball Rugby on Twitter. So Leinster versus Saracens, Toulouse versus Saracens, Leinster Munster, or Toulouse versus Munster. What was the say? What is the final lineup going to be? 47% of you said it is going to be Leinster against Saracens. 14% went for Toulouse against Saracens. Leinster and Munster got 26% of the vote, including... Is that Tommy? Is that you voting there? I see the little tick beside it. Tommy thinks it's going to be Leinster against Munster. And then 13%, the smallest vote, is going to be two upsets this weekend, Toulouse against Munster. What way are you calling it?
Yeah, I think it's probably hard to disagree with that. The one thing I would say is as the week was going on, I was getting more hopeful and optimistic, but then having heard yesterday that Earls looked like he's going to miss out. Like I said, Jean Klein isn't 100% fit, whether he starts or not, he's not 100% fit. And then Joey Carberry, they're massive players. Mm-hmm. Three massive players from Munster, and then Sarri's getting their big guns back. So I think Earls missing is a game changer. And you don't often say that, actually, about a winger, do you, to be fair? But that's how important he is to Munster. Again, we saw it in the Edinburgh game. So, yeah, I think Sarri's will probably nick it. But hopefully Munster, like I said, fire a shot and you know, do what they're capable of. I can't see Leinster. I can't see Leinster losing. It's such a big game. It's a big stage. They've so many big players who are looking to play themselves back into form. We didn't even mention Sean O'Brien, but this feels like a massive game for him. You heard Lancaster came out this week and you know, was calling for a big performance, and he was up doing media last week before the Glasgow game, and he was kind of saying, you know, there's more to come for me. We didn't really see that against Glasgow, and I was asking him, has he tailored his game, but he, you know, in terms of carrying, but he said that's the one part of his game that, you know, is the missing piece at the moment, because we haven't seen him, have we, as a destructive force. He seems to be hitting a lot more rucks, but the stage is set for these guys, Sexton coming back in to prove a point. And, you know, at the Aviva, they're so hard to beat there. So, yeah, I'd imagine it would probably be Leinster, Sarries, but keeping both fingers crossed for an All-Irish final.
You're on duty at the Aviva. You're not in commentary, are you?
No, I'm not. Looking forward to it, actually. Yeah, well, the two games are going to be crackers, aren't they? It's a great weekend. And like I said, after all the stuff about Falau and Billy Vunipola, it's great to actually just have two cracking rugby games to look forward to.
OK, Cian, thanks for coming into us, and enjoy the Aviva on Sunday. OK, that's all from us this morning on OTBM. But before we go, we have to bring you the winner of our brilliant competition we've been running here all week. With thanks to Turkish Airlines, proud sponsors of Cricket Ireland, we've been giving one lucky OTBM viewer the chance to fly anywhere in the world with Turkish Airlines ahead of a
a cracking summer of cricket for Ireland as they host some of the biggest teams in the world. And we have our winner. Congratulations to John Carswell. And just a reminder that on May 3rd, the Ireland men's team will face England in Malahide with a tri-series against Bangladesh and West Indies to follow. It's one of the busiest summers ever in Irish cricket, so keep an eye on all of that. That is all we have time for this morning. We have lots coming up across Off the Ball platforms over the weekend. Tomorrow, live commentary of Saracens against Munster in the Champions Cup semi-final from Coventry. And we also have Everton against Manchester United on Sunday, as well as Cardiff versus Liverpool live from 1 p.m. on News Talk on both Saturday and Sunday. Tomorrow as well on Today FM, you can hear live commentary of Man City against Spurs in the Premier League. That'll be live online on todayfm.com/PLL from 12:15 p.m. And then from the radio show at 2 o'clock on the FM, you can hear live commentary of West Ham against Leicester City. That'll all be with Philip Egan tomorrow afternoon. Off the Ball is back from 7 o'clock tonight. Until then, see ya.
So, if you like this, you'll probably also like OTB AM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream or catch the show live on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook or offtheball.com every morning from 7:45 a.m.